Hello and welcome. It's another Q&A episode of our Books of the Year podcast. We're talking to Catriona Ward, award-winning author, best-selling author. Stephen King loves her, and so can you. Her current book is Looking Glass Sound. You can hear her talk about that book in detail in our companion podcast. But the Q&A always starts with this question, Catriona. What is the last book that you really, really enjoyed reading? We're not after kind of mildly amused by, but really had a fantastic time with.
There's one book that gave me, probably the book that gave me the most serious writer's envy, where I was so torn between just reveling in what the writer was doing and also wishing I myself had written it, was Mrs. March by Virginia Feito, which is, it's extraordinary. It's about a New York socialite who whose husband is a writer, and she stopped reading his books because, you know, who can be bothered after 30 erudite volumes. But she discovers that in his latest one, there's a character modelled after her, which is a very sad, aged prostitute who is so pathetic that no one can actually be bothered to sleep with her. And this provokes a sort of intense, almost psychotic break as she comes to suspect that perhaps her husband is doing more than just writing this sort of vicious narrative, and perhaps he might be doing physical harm to people as well. And she goes on a sort of detective hunt, but it's accompanied by this descent into paranoia, which I found firstly deeply relatable, and secondly just so persuasive. It's got its roots in those real classics like Perkins Gilman's The Yellow Wallpaper, and all of those gothic novels of female instability and neurosis, which turns out to be either true or not true. It really impressed me. I was, as I said, incredibly jealous when I read it.
Are there any books, Catriona, that you remember the most from your childhood? I suppose that's either one book or maybe a collection, because I suppose when we're kids, if you find one book you like, you then devour everything written by that author. But what stands out the most from your childhood?
Well, I mean, I still don't think this is a children's book at all, but Watership Down is sort of an extraordinary piece of writing. It happens to be about rabbits, but it's got a lot of things operating at the same time in it, doesn't it? It's a sort of platonic ideal of society. It's also, you know, a fantastic fantasy with, you know, really intense and detailed world building. And it's incredibly English. So I didn't grow up in the UK. I mainly grew up in the tropics. So I knew most of what I knew about the English countryside from this book. I didn't really know what a cowslip was. I'd never really seen, you know, most of the weather that Richard Adams talks about. And it was incredibly exotic to me. It sort of added another layer to heighten the air of fantasy to it, if you will. I just think it's a kind of a perfect book to talk about, perfect in a sense, but I learned about mortality from that book. I learned about death. I think it's okay to spoil Watership Down, isn't it? You know, this long after publication, but, you know.
Yes.
Well, you never know.
For anyone who hasn't read it, spoilers ahead. There's that end paragraph where Hazel finally lets go of his body and leaves it by a ditch, and he follows El Herrera, the rabbit god, off across the fields, knowing that his descendants and thousands like them will all be all right. And I think the last line is, "They'll be all right. Come with me, and I'll show you what I mean." And it's very, very beautiful. It's also quite unique in that it presents death as something, you know, there are many kinds of death in the book. You know, there are horrible ones. There's torture. There's some quite extreme stuff. But this particular incident is immortality is not something to be feared, but something that fits into the natural order of things in this particular case. And you feel it as a very organic and not frightening process at all. So as a first experience of kind of thinking about these things, I think it's probably it's a complicated one, but perhaps, you know, perhaps a sort of good one, in that it presents all sorts of ideas about, you know, death not being the thing most to be dreaded.
I now have Bright Eyes by Art Garfunkel playing in my head, yeah, which I will do for the rest of the day, I suspect.
I apologise for that.
No, it's fine. I like Art Garfunkel. Do you have a writing routine? Are you quite ritualistic? Do you always like to write in the same place at the same time, or are you super flexible?
The thing is, it gets so incredibly stultifying and kind of harrowing, staring at the same small patch of screen day after day after day, that I tend to try and vary the background behind the screen as much as possible. So, for instance, here on a stormy hilltop in France, I really welcome it. I'm delighted by the thunderstorm. I'm delighted by something to, you know, lend the drama. I used to, before the pandemic, just go and get on a train. I live quite near Paddington Station, so I'd walk there and I'd get on a train. Nowhere too far, like maybe, you know, to like Brighton and back. I think Peterborough. But there was something about the forward motion of the train and being in public but not in public. So being private and able to be in your own little world, but also having people around you, that really started my engines. I mean, it's quite an expensive way to write, so I didn't do it too often. But sometimes when I was stuck, it really helped. I mean, I've taken my laptop into the woods before. That was quite unsuccessful, very damp. But, you know...
Wow.
But you get this thing sometimes, which I refer to as going inside the computer, where you just you get so sucked in by what's on the page and the narrow focus of trying to get everything down that actually you forget to tell the story. Whereas actually what should be happening is all of these sort of like, you know, ambient like passions and ideas and stories should be visiting you from the ether, from the outside, and being channeled through you. Whereas actually sometimes what just happens is you end up staring minutely at like a sentence you've just written 37 times. So for me, the best thing to do is to change things up as much as possible. So the answer to that is I have no routine at all and avoid it like the plague.
I love the idea of getting a train out of Paddington by choice. Oh my goodness.
Yes. Look out, Slough. Here we come.
Oh, what? Clearly haven't been to Paddington recently, Catriona. Oh my goodness.
No,
right, you trained as an actor. Would you ever appear in a screen adaptation of one of your books, perhaps?
I don't think they'd have me. But I'd be delighted to have other people appear in them. I mean, I was so unsuccessful as an actor, I can't tell you. It was sort of all right. I did a few things, but I only did them with people who I'd already sort of worked with or done stuff or kind of, you know, organically met or were friends or something, because I found that I couldn't audition. And unfortunately, auditioning is the entire job. That's it. That's the job. And if you can't do that, you're kind of sunk. So I gave up. I mean, it's that eternal question of, you know, if like a tree falling in the forest, if an actor gives up and no one notices, you know, were they really ever acting in the first place? But, yeah. You know, it had been something I'd really wanted to do ever since I was a kid. So there was a sort of grief to it. But I think in retrospect, I'm better off where I am. I think that there are things in common, you know, that you have in terms of storytelling. Like I still use a lot of my acting training to write out the beats of a scene or to construct character or things like that. It's sort of in me. And I think it can be quite useful. But God, it's such a relief to make your mistakes on the page instead of in front of a room full of people.
We like to surprise our guests with, instead of a question coming from me or Matt, a voice note from someone who likes your work. So in the last Q&A we had, which was with Harlan Coben, we featured Richard Osman, who is a fan. And today, Catriona, we have a note from his brother, who is a fan of yours, and as you know, is Suede's guitarist and author. He is Matt Osman. Here's the question.
Hi, Kat. It's Matt Osman here. I was wondering, you spend weeks in the headspace of some of the worst people in the world, murderers and madmen and manipulators. And I was wondering, how do you manage to clear your head afterwards? Do you have an exorcist on speed dial?
Good question.
That's an excellent question. Thanks, Matt. Amazing. It speaks badly of me, but I find the more I put them on the page, the less troubled I am, actually. I used to have terrible night terrors. And actually, when I started writing, I've kind of found the cage to contain the demon, really. I also think there's a sort of... I mean, sometimes, to be fair, yeah, I do have to go and, like, look at a nice horse or something at the end of the day and come up for air. I mean, I think, you know, having someone you love just give you a shake and tell you to snap out of it can be very useful as well. But strangely, I'm the more I write the horror, the less it occupies space in my head. So, you know, the writing in itself is a sort of exorcism, I guess, if that's enough of an answer.
Sure.
We sort of divide writers in a very sweeping generalisation here, Catriona, between planners and pantsers. In other words, what, yes. Planners being the ones who put everything up on a corkboard and post-it notes and know exactly where they're going, and pantsers being the Lee Childs, Ian Rankins, Marina Hydes of this world, who can just sit down in front of a blank piece of paper and write. So which of those two sweeping generalisations would you find yourself in?
Okay, I think I vary between the two at various stages of the process. So I think at the beginning, it's almost like a map. So I've got tentpole, I know where I'm starting and I know where I'm finishing. How the hell I get there, who knows? That's the fun of it. So I've got to have what's sort of traditionally called a twist. I prefer the word reveal, because I feel like what that moment should do, that twist or reveal moment should do, is uncover the true nature of the world or the characters that you've been living in. So I know if you see it like a map, you know, I know my starting point and I know my destination, but where we visit along the way is always incredibly pantsy, as it were. So I tend to go with two strong ideas, beginning and end, which are very rarely migrate, actually, usually stay very much the same. The middle is no man's land in any anyone's guess.
How many? This is almost an impossible question. So you know, we'll take a rough guess. How many books do you have on your shelves at home or your homes? And are you a filer? You know, are they following some kind of order if we were to visit?
They have absolutely no order at all. I tend to remember them by the ones that I've read most recently. Will be nearest the door, or where, you know, where I'll reach into the room and grab them, you know. So that's the sort of way I tend to mentally file them. But I quite like that sort of chaos to it as well. I reckon it's very impossible. I'm going to guess that I have about 1,000 books between my poor parents. I unloaded a lot of my books on them after moving to London. So between London and my parents' very kind library that they maintain for me, I'd say about 1,000 books. It's a lot. It's too many. I should cull. But the thing is, they all have some kind of meaning, don't they? And it's very hard to, as I've discovered, to recycle or give away books, because I think charity shops no longer want them because they get too many, which is a sad realization for a writer. But I do think there's something about a room full of books that is intensely comforting, as I think we all would agree. And walking in, you know, it's very hard to sacrifice those. Even in the day and age of digital copies, it's very hard to sacrifice that experience of, like, standing in front of the shelves and smelling them, you know.
I'd agree with you about the problem with being able to recycle books. I've been turned away from several charity shops now. Yeah. I've found out that my local tube station takes books, though. So I just go there and leave. And they all disappear. It's brilliant. Yeah, can't get over it.
I tried to donate books to prison charities, but apparently you're not allowed to give things to prisoners unless you know them, which I should have thought of.
Oh yeah, send Prison Break books. Yes, Count of Monte Cristo. Maybe not. Yeah. In a future dystopian world, Catriona, if the warlords have declared that you can only have one genre of novel, and that would be all you'd be able to read, what would you choose, and would it be horror?
Do you know, I think it would. Yeah, it would. I think particularly, you know, just as a handy survival guide in this dystopian future, you know, horror prepares you for everything, doesn't it? It's a sort of means of mental rehearsal, in a way, for disaster. And it speaks to the deep parts of us, you know, it speaks to the parts we're not really that willing to discuss. It, you know, fear, anger, our particular sort of inner demons. I'd take horror for sure.
And on that optimistic and encouraging and warm...
Are you so glad I came on the show?
No. Yes, of course we are. Catriona, a real pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much indeed. Looking Glass Sound is published by Viper and comes out on April the 20th. You can pre-order it now. Remember, if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We'll be back next week. Thank you for listening, Catriona. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your holiday.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.